Hello and welcome to Future Library. It's been one of those weeks where I'm recording a whole load of these, so I've lost track of what number this is, so I'm not even going to worry about that. My guest today is an American musician. She has been active for quite some time, according to Wikipedia. And rather than going through the whole, you know, who would it be, guess, because as I said before on the podcast, that's completely redundant because the guest's name is the title of this podcast, so you know who it is already if you're listening to this. I'm joined by Blevin Blechtum. Hello, Blevin.
Hello.
How are you today?
Very well, thanks.
I believe you're very cold where you are.
Yeah, I'm wearing a hood within a hood and a heater. My feet are on a heater. Yes, it's cold in Providence, Rhode Island right now.
You're double hooding.
Let me turn that sound off. I am double hooding, yes.
And with a heater as well, so, yeah.
Well, my studio is in the unheated part of the apartment, yes.
I see. But you see, in the UK, we've had really nice, kind of very mild winter so far. It just means that the shit's going to hit the fan around kind of February, and it'll be horrible then, like it was last year. So, but we're not very
good. February's horrible here too, so don't be too envious.
I will feel okay about it. I'm actually married to an American, and I was in Minneapolis when it was very snowy, and I've been in Montreal when it's snowy. So I've experienced the very, very cold. Yeah. So where to start? I have got some notes, and obviously, as it always goes, I always forget these things. Blevin, I know who you are, but some of the listeners may not. Tell us a bit about yourself.
I am an electronic musician and performer, and recently do more multimedia video and custom controller kinds of things. Sound design, I guess I'm a composer, sound designer, and started playing and recording. Well, I have a solo Blevin Blechtum thing, but my band is Blechtum from Blechtum with Kristen Erickson, a.k.a. Kevin Blechtum. So I'm still working on both of those projects, and what else would you like to know? I use mostly Pro Tools, Ableton Live, and Maxin Live, and Max MSP, I guess. Those are what I tend to work in.
You have preempted my geek questions, which were going to be, what do you use? I was going to ask, are you kind of an Ableton kind of person, or have you gone down the Luke Fishbeck Lucky Dragons route of programming everything in Max MSP? But you've answered that question.
No, I only use Max MSP as a sound generating source and a controller driver kind of thing. I'm in Blechtum from Blechtum, I'm the sound designer composer half, and Kristen is the programmer composer half. I do program a bit, but that's not my obsession.
You see, I've never worked out how to do it. I have got Max MSP, and I look at it occasionally and just go, no, I've no idea where to start with this. So I like Ableton Live because it's
I do too.
Super flexible, and it does everything I need it to do, and I can record in it, and I can perform with it.
It's both friendly and deep.
I've been using it since version one on an old. It was an old PowerBook, one of the black ones. With no USB, it was a Wall Street.
The black clamshell.
Yeah. When the Apple used to be upside down when you opened the lid.
Yeah.
You know, back before they realized that had happened.
That's what Kristen had when we first started playing together in 98, and she was running a very squirrely version of Max MEP, squirrely because it would just crash every time, squirrely, because she was new to programming it probably too. But she had the black clamshell running Max, and I had a Dr. Sample sampler, and that was what we played with for the first year. Nice. and edited in Pro Tools free.
Fantastic.
My first two solo things and her first and our first three all of our Blechtum from Blechtum stuff was edited. All of those things were edited in Pro Tools free.
Yeah,
one level of undo makes you pay attention to what you're doing.
I used Pro Tools Free a few times. It always seems so kind of unwieldy for some reason. My main memory of that laptop, which I actually have it in this room somewhere. Actually, I can see it from where I'm sitting. My main memory, apart from the fact that it only had 8 gigs of hard drive and 192 megs of RAM, was how much it weighed. And it's it weighs something like 4 or 5 times what my MacBook does. It's just...
Yeah, no, it was a...
crazy thing.
Lifting experience, yeah.
Yeah, so that answered the geek question. Yes.
Good. We've gotten that out of the way.
We have, because a few weeks ago, listeners might remember, I spoke to Celia Hollander, who performs as 333. And we spent a long time talking about Ableton. I think we spent half the podcast talking about it. So let's just move on from Ableton. We'll just take it as read. Ableton's good.
And, like it.
Because people have got used to on the podcast that Ableton is good. We have ascertained that Bandcamp is good over the various episodes and various things like that. So I think we could just take all those things as read. So so what kind of drew you into... How did you kind of get into the kind of performing... What pulled you into music in the first place?
Let's see. I grew up on, I guess, the first electronic music that I heard was Wendy Carlos, Switched on Bach, and at the same time I was listening to some strange sort of half or music story, some really interesting early sound design and field recording and tape speed and all sorts of stuff by Jim Kopp and Ed Brown, and I talk about them all the time. but they were they made kids records, so these strange kids records with really interesting sound. I listened to those a lot when I was really young. I listened to Wendy Carlos, and the first time I heard it, I was really blown away because I was pushed to do classical music, and that was like, oh, now classical music is very interesting to me, which it wasn't, you know, it wasn't compelling. It's always nice to have some kind of, I guess, physical and rigorous training early in something like music, which I always loved music, but I didn't love being a violinist. So I transitioned, slowly but surely. The first time I heard Kraftwerk was in a 7th grade gym class, and that was another like moment of this is what I really like. Yeah, I sidestepped into, eventually sidestepped into the electronic music program at Mills College in Oakland, California, and that really just gave me access to tools, and I met Kristen there, access to tools and more time to work on music, even with a day job. So then I've done it ever since, really, in and out of sound design, corporate sound design jobs, and just doing, music as much as I can outside of that kind of thing. And I'm finishing up, I don't know, the academic thing is always more survivalist than my calling, I think, although I do like teaching. I like just playing and being in my own world more, I guess.
I thought it was interesting you mentioned the Jim Kopp and Ed Brown stuff, because I've got the page from The Wire up when you
did the inner sleeve thing.
Yeah.
I go on and on about them.
Yeah, when you've mentioned them, I thought, that's another thing I can tick off the list of things I was going to ask about. Yeah, because I remember looking at these when I got that issue and just thinking, those are fantastic covers.
So they were a couple. They weren't out as a couple, but they were a couple for a really long time. One wrote all the music. They both did the voices. They did all of the voices, children, adults, like, again, with tape speed, and did all the recorded strange instruments that they built, and played a lot of toy piano, and did all the art. So one did the art, one did the music, and they both did the voices and wrote the stories.
So it was, let's have a look. So it was, Ed Brown did all the artwork, and apart from the line drawing, the little weird man with no arms that seems to adorn their covers. You see, these are things that, it's good. This is what, I like The Wire because it has things like that. It's a good thing. Sorry.
That and I guess that and Jack Flanders, which were some weird radio plays done by ZBC Productions. Meatball Fulton is the guy's name, and those were psychedelic, slightly more adult, but maybe not. I don't know. They're kind of equally bizarre long form radio plays that don't make a lot of narrative sense, but have really interesting sound design, music, and loose plot in them.
And I think there's not enough of that in the world, I think.
No.
We need more of this stuff where people have to concentrate to even pick out the plot at all. I think, you know, maybe we get things...
Or just be left confused.
Yes. I think we've spoon-fed too many things.
Yeah.
I think we need to either have things that are kind of colossally complex or things that are just genuinely confusing.
Less orchestral swells.
Yes. Yes, which brings me actually quite neatly to your music. Listening back today, refamiliarising myself with some of the records, I noticed there's a kind of fidgety kind of surface detail to your work that sort of struck me. Kind of a very trebly kind of upper kind of foam sitting on the top of it all the time. Is there a kind of conscious thing that, or is your approach to making music similar to mine, where you just start making it and whatever comes out the other end comes out the other end? Or do you plan meticulously?
It's a combination of playing around with materials and layering and heavily curating and then heavily editing. So the initial process, and this is similar in Blechdom from Blechdom, is like lots of quick and not necessarily directed creation of material. Or, you know, it's never, for me, it's rarely to never being struck with a lightning bolt and I have this magic, I have a plan, I have a symphony in my head. I don't, I pull out, but when I hear something, when I hear the right, smaller or slightly larger, usually it's very small pieces. When I hear the right pieces, I grab them and then I layer and manipulate them and put them with the other ones that belong next to each other. So stack them and, destroy them and recreate them and then put them in another software and do the same thing. And then usually ends up in Pro Tools. But I'm increasingly doing more composition in, or, you know, like production. Whatever if you want to call it, creation. I used to always start in Pro Tools, and now I start in Ableton sometimes too. But I tend to like maximal thing, I think that word has been used to define things in a way that I don't really consider it. But I like lots of things going on. I like lots of structure, even if it might not seem like structure sometimes. I like a lot of structure, and I like a lot of to me, emotive spaces.
Well, to me, so listening to it, it kind of brings a kind of visual image of looking through lots of layers of sort of thin twigs or branches.
Oh, cool.
And kind of a real kind of depth of them. Kind of like a kind of structure made of lots of layers and things.
Are you implying a nest? Because I
almost
work with
a nest,
birds.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely, yes. And that was another thing I was going to ask you about. Because you do indeed. Oh, and talking of birds, my cat has just arrived, so I'll just pop her down like that. I've taken her bell off because she was jingling all around the room earlier. So if you can hear her purring at some point, that's why. I've got a Siamese cat called Skye.
you might hear some tweeting in the background. Because there's cockatiels in the kitchen and a umbrella cockatoo in the other room that might start screeching if you hear dinosaur-like pterosaur screaming. That's my cockatoo.
Fantastic. Well, I think that's what we need to also have is more animals on the show. The cat has now started licking my arm. Okay. She's one of these cats that grooms me. She sits and just grooms me.
Oh, that's sweet.
Which is, I think it's meant to be a sign of respect or something. So that's quite nice. She's a very nice cat. So, yeah, so because I remember reading that, I read an interview with you where you were talking about the birds and stuff, but you also mentioned that you were trying to work out how to get the most sound out of sound chips for, was it Leapfrog you were working for at the time?
Yeah, I worked for Leapfrog and some other companies in the Bay Area. Yeah, I worked for Leapfrog doing sound for electronic toys. And I worked for Thomas Dolby's startup Beatnik. That was my first real audio job, but that was more testing the Beatnik player. He wanted to sonify the web. I think that technology is in Nokia phones now, but that company doesn't exist anymore. But Leapfrog was using that player, so I got hired because they knew how to use the Beatnik player. And yeah.
So are there any toys?
I don't want to work corporate 9-to-5 sound anymore, really. Although it has its charms. I'm about to need to find a new I'm transitioning in May to some job that I have no idea what it will be yet. So I've been thinking about that kind of thing lately. So I might end up back in sound design, but it would be cool to be working on not on a tiny chip, but on some sort of games or something. Yeah. I don't know. We'll see. Theater. I love doing sound for theater. If I could find a job doing that all the time, I would do that.
Well, if any of my small yet growing listenership has a job in the area in Rhode Island that is doing theater, Blevin's available. So, send some money.
We'll travel.
Yeah. Oh, there we go then. Excellent. It reminds me a little bit what you're saying about doing stuff for corporations and things. It reminds me a bit of Goody Powell and his famous stories of doing things for people like Nokia and Chupa Chups and getting it all. Yeah. For some reason, a bit of background. I don't know if you've listened to any of the shows. I've interviewed Goody Powell. He actually came and stayed at my house. I can't imagine how Goody Powell ended up doing that. It's kind of, but
yeah,
then,
I don't know.
He's one of those people that he seems to end up doing a lot of things, and you kind of think, how does that happen? What company goes to Goody Powell and says, could you make an advert for us, or the sound for this or that? I think he famously got into a lot of trouble with them because he then released all the audio. But then that's a typical Goody Powell thing. So I was going to ask you, are there any toys that are out there that have your sounds in them that, you know, kids are unaware of listening to?
Oh, yeah. Probably. I don't know if that was a while ago, but I did a lot on the LeapPad talking books, like a Winnie the Pooh book, which was like a touch and talk kind of book. And I did a lot of alphabet songs, and I did pretty much everything in the Baby Tad plush toy for a while. And I did some fur real pets when I was working for a different company that did freelance for Fisher Price and Hasbro and a bunch of other places. So that's the cat, the fake cat that when you touch it in different ways, animatronic cat, when you touch it in different ways, it makes different emotional cat sounds. So I think the description was, please make 40 cat sounds that sound realistic and express human emotions. Which is,
and then was it a case of, and then cram them on this 4-bit chip? Which has no space for any of these things, which I guess is always right. But there must be something satisfying about knowing that, there's kids out there who are playing with things that are, without knowing it, hearing sounds that you've made.
Yeah, it is. It's cool to like find a toy and pick it up and know that you put it out there. That said, it's heavily curated by a huge team of marketing and scripting, and it sounds more creative than it is, I think, sometimes.
You're not giving free rein, you're basically saying. You can't just put any sound.
Yeah. I mean, of course you're not, cool. I mean, I think it's actually better for, like, as a technical challenge, like, both compositionally or production-wise, it's just a challenge to produce that much and like take these things on like math problems almost, like make a cat sound like a human but also like a cat.
I'm going to sound slightly distant for a second because I've just realized why my cat's looking so antsy. It's because she's shut in the room with me. I'm now back. So I just opened the door for her. She was looking a bit concerned and then coming back to me and then looking concerned, but staying quiet.
She needs to prowl.
She kind of was going back and forth and was going, what's going on? She'll come back at some point. which has slightly wrecked my train of thought. What was I going to say? There was something.
Sound design is fun, and you hear it in toys on shelves of Walmart.
That was it. That was the thing I was going to ask. Was it Leapfrog who were responsible for the famous Disney one that had the monkey sounding like he was saying something rude?
Maybe. They did have a toy early in their time, like really early in their time, but it took a lot to make it happen. I actually never heard it, and I heard it happened before I got there. So I can't take credit for it.
It was the Lion King talking book. And you pushed the button for the monkey, and he sang a little song, and it sounded like he was singing Stuff a Banana Up Your Ass.
It's really easy to have things not sound like they should.
Yeah.
Basically anything like an S is just a shaped burst of white noise by that point if it's on a shape.
Yeah, I can imagine it. I can totally imagine listening to it that it was meant to be something else. It was probably directly sampled from the movie and through all the compression and everything that had to go on to get it into that little thing. It went from being some little happy song to being this kind of shove a banana up your ass, shove a banana. Right. Which is probably only the kind of thing it's maybe people wouldn't have noticed it if somebody hadn't said, oh, that sounds a bit like that. And then you can hear nothing but that.
Totally. And if you know what it is beforehand, you probably will never hear it like that. But once you are removed from the original, like if you never saw it written on paper, you're always going to hear it as the, shove it up your arse.
Go on. What were you going to say?
There's something inherently absurd and hilarious about working at a toy company, like toy emergency, like an emergency, like it's a toy emergency. Like the worst thing. I mean, of course, somebody's losing money, so to them, it's a real emergency. But you know, like getting a call and being like, you know, it's an emergency. Come here now. Is kind of funny because it's a toy, really.
It's like what's happened is the ladder wrong or on the fire engine or something.
Yeah, A doesn't sound quite like A.
Yeah, I guess
there's a lot of alphabet toys.
Yeah. I guess the thing is the closer you are to something. So I guess if somebody's really working in that industry and it's their livelihood and their life, it is the most important thing in the world. And it's the same, I think, with any job. Once you're a few steps removed from it, something that seems like life and death keep you awake at night kind of thing just seems ludicrous from a few steps, you know, removed. Yeah. It's like, you know, I'm sure there's people who get very, very stressed about whether lines on crossings are the right width and lose sleep going, oh my God, they've done this crossing at the junction and it's all wrong. And nobody notices, nobody cares. It's a millimetre wrong. Nobody's ever going to care. But, you know, there's somebody somewhere going, oh no, that's so bad. Anyway, let's go back to let's pull things back onto the music side of things. Now, you've released various albums over the years. Now, the one that I wanted to kind of ask about, and probably not for the reason you expect, and I'm going to mispronounce this, Gular Flutter? Is that the correct pronunciation?
Yeah, that's, pronunciation I know, which I think is maybe right in some sense, is Gular Flutter. And it's a bird. It's a thing that some birds and reptiles do. It's a flap of skin that comes down from under their beak or their chin. And it's a really basic way of cooling down and chilling out, because if they flap this membrane of skin, it dissipates heat. So I actually was working at a bird, at International Bird Rescue and Research Center in Northern California, and I worked as a volunteer there when I was doing veterinary tech stuff, and a cormorant, I think, came in and was doing it really a lot because it was stressed and overheated and ill, and the woman I was working with liked to tease me sometimes, and she was like, it's Gular Fluttering, and I thought she was teasing me. And then I went home and looked it up, and it was a real thing. And then I came back and I told her that was my next album title. And it is. It was.
The thing I want to ask about that, and I'm hoping that Wikipedia hasn't lied to me in this one, artwork by China Mieville.
Yes.
You see, this kind of leapt out at me because I have a vague recollection that one of the people who reacted to my initial post about Ian Banks dying was yourself on Facebook.
Oh!
And that's what I kind of thought, this ties in neatly, because there's a bit of a sci-fi thing here. And yes.
Yeah, both me and my brother are obsessive about sci-fi and just wrote. Well, I'll send you the files. I can't put them out there, or I can't say what author or story it is because we're working out copyright stuff. Right. But my brother and I did an adaptation of a short story for electronics, two recorded voices, two live voices, and the two live voices are also playing a violin and a viola. Fantastic. And I think it's my favorite thing that I've worked on in a long time. The other favorite thing is the new Blechtum from Blechtum record, which will be out in the spring, hopefully. But yeah, science fiction.
Yeah. And so well, firstly, how did you end up getting China Miéville doing the record cover for that one?
I just asked him and he said he would.
And isn't that amazing that that's actually what works so often?
Yeah.
This is what I found doing the podcast is that I just ask people. And most people either ignore you completely or just say yes.
Yeah, it's kind of nice when you get a random yes from something that you... Yeah, it's fun. It's good.
So I really like Chani Mayville's books. I will say that with a caveat, though. There's one of his I don't like very much. I liked all the stuff with the kind of fantasy steampunk stuff. Yeah, it's the one I don't like is Embassy Town.
I have not read that one.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about. I won't tell you the story of Embassy Town because I don't want to spoil it for you. It's not a bad book, but I think compared to his other work, it's not as good because I really liked the sort of steampunky stuff, and I really liked The City in the City, especially. I thought that was an excellent book, and even though the idea was kind of bizarre, he managed to pull it off and make you really believe that this could happen. And Kraken, I thought, was fantastic. And neatly had a thing about Star Trek teleporters that I've thought forever about the transporters. And I was reading it. I was like, oh, yes, somebody else has said this as well. Yes, yes. Thank you, God, that somebody else recognises that they're a horrifying idea. But, yeah, Embassy Town, which is, I think, his first attempt at full-on kind of in-space sci-fi, for me it didn't feel that it kind of fully flowed. It felt like it was a half-finished book. And it's one of these books, you know those books where you read them and while you're reading them, you don't really enjoy them. And then when you think back over them, you actually go, well, actually, that's a really good idea. And I'm kind of glad I read it, but I just wish the way it had been handled was a little bit better. So
I'll have to read it and then we can discuss.
Yeah, let me know on Facebook what you thought about it when you read it. It's a really interesting story. It's an interesting idea about language and how language can affect things, but it's... I don't know, for me, some other people may love it, but for me it didn't rise to the heights of some of his other work. Yeah.
There's an album equivalent of that somewhere.
Is there?
I feel like I've made the musical equivalent of that.
The one where it's kind of good but not as good.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Most of those I haven't put out, though.
Oh, well, there you go. That's the thing. But yeah, the whole sci-fi thing, I think, I mean, I'm going to talk about sci-fi for a bit. I was gutted when Ian Banks died because I genuinely think he was the best sci-fi writer alive at the time. I think his culture novels are just, there's nobody that could do that as well. You know.
Yeah, I agree.
The humour, the kind of epic scope of the stories. He really wrote these colossally widescreen tales that were...
I love the artificial intelligences.
Yes.
In his work, especially.
I introduced my wife to them by making her read Accession. That was the first...
I just finished that, actually. There are a couple that I just hadn't read yet, and I thought I had read that one, and then my brother was talking to me about it, and I realized I had not read it, and... Yeah, that's one of my favorites.
It's fantastic. The whole conceit of having the major characters in a book being supermassive sentient starships. it's like, yeah, that's so good. The human characters in it are so secondary to these ships having conversations with one another. And I remember describing it to my wife saying, you know, there's a few chapters in there. The first few chapters, you're going to be reading them going, what the hell is this? It's almost like machine code. And I said, by the end of it, you'll be reading it going, yeah, I know exactly what that means because you'll have worked it all out. But it's all those kind of those chapters of conversation when it's all kind of coordinates and tight beam and narrow beam and all this kind of stuff. And you know, and the ship ships are all talking to each other and pinging replies off each other and stuff.
Yeah, the ship conversations are the ship interaction, social interaction of the ships, I find really endlessly entertaining and fascinating.
And I think there's a reference, I think it gets referenced again in, what was it? It's one of his recent ones. Was it Surface Detail? There's some mention of the ships, because I think that's the one with the wars in hell. War in the virtual hells, and I think there's some mention of the Interesting Times gang from Accession and how nobody's heard from them for a long time. And I just like the whole idea of the culture. The culture to me is, if I could live anywhere, the culture would be the place I would choose to live.
It would be high on my list.
Yeah, it's just the whole idea of a kind of utopian post-scarcity kind of borderline anarchist society where the only real rules are based on what other people think of you. So as long as your reputation's sound, then, you know, you're going to be all right. So just all, everybody behaves themselves because they want to maintain a good reputation. And I think that's fantastic. I think, you know, I'm becoming more socialist as I'm getting older as well. So I think that appeals to me. And obviously Banks' left-wing politics really appeal to me. And yeah, so I think it was a huge loss to the world when he died. I think. I haven't yet read his last book. I've got The Quarry.
I haven't either.
I kind of have this feeling about it. It's sitting on my Kindle, ready to read, and I kind of feel that once I've read it, that's it, finished.
Yeah, I'm putting off reading the last couple that I haven't read yet, including that one.
Yeah. But it's fantastic. Any listeners who haven't read Ian Banks, I've talked about him before on the show. Fantastic. I want people to make films of his books. You know, it's why aren't we seeing these things at the cinema?
Yeah. I gave in and torrented Ender's Game, and it was terrible.
Was it not good?
Not good.
No, you see, I've not read the books. I have those.
I haven't read that book. I read one of the other ones, but I haven't read that book. So. Yeah, not good. But yeah, someone should make an amazing Ian Banks book movie.
Yeah, I kind of think which one would be a good one. I think The Player of Games could be quite good.
Yeah, that could be great.
Or consider Phlebas has a lot of very kind of cinematic kind of set pieces, kind of one after the other. The whole thing with the kind of gigantic liners. And, yeah.
Maybe just someone should do it animated.
Possibly. Or a series.
And then... Like, or what?
Or a series, kind of like...
A series. Yeah, definitely. That's my... The long-form serial is my favorite, and I think that would be perfect for...
Yeah, the other thing I think that would be really good, I mean, if you had the kind of a length of time, you know, that you've had over something like Breaking Bad, somebody should get the Kim Stanley Robinson Mars books and make those into a serial.
Those I have not read those.
They are worth reading. They are heavy going.
My brother has told me to read them, and I just haven't yet.
I would recommend setting aside 6 months of reading those and nothing else, because it will take that amount of time, because they're just so long. Each of them's about 400 to 600 pages, and there's three of them. So it does seem to go on forever. But by the end of it, what has been a slog at the beginning, by the end of it, you're going, I want more of this. You know, they're not quite like Ian Banks, where, you know, you fly through 600 pages in a week and go, I've read that so fast. They are a bit heavy going, but... Yeah. They're spectacular. So, you know, so that's that. So, yeah, that actually ticks off all my notes I had. So, you've got a new album.
Called Emblem Album.
Tell us about that.
I have it out. It's out on Agoo. It came out December 7th. The label is Agoo, A-A-G-O-O. Alec Dartley, runs that label single-handedly, pretty much, and he put out Guler Flitter as well. And I'm playing some shows in April in the sort of northern United States and a bit of Canada with a band called Sontag Shogun, I think I'm saying right. Anyway, Jeremy and Jesse, and that will be really fun. I played some shows in New York for it. The first few tracks are a name taken from a M. John Harrison story, one of the Variconium stories. Because I was messing around with doing like doing for some project I had to do, did a short adaptation of something of his, and the Lamian Lord Chromas, which I haven't finished or really done correctly yet, but that track was from some of that material, so it working title is stuck for the first two tracks on the record. So I guess it's confusing because it has the first two are more rhythmic and dancey, and then the last half of the record is more disintegrated and swirly and dissolved Scarlatti harpsichord tangents. But yeah,
so that's
I like it. I'm glad it's done. It took me a long time because I was back in school, and I thought I could juggle everything and put stuff out as often as I usually did, but it took longer to get this one out, so it's been 5 years since Schooler Flitter, and I'm really happy it's out. I really love the way it came out physically and sonically. Thomas DiMuzio mastered it, and he's great, and I was able to acquire this wearable piece of art that my friend Joe Siegel made, and who teaches textiles at RISD, and it's a very, very heavy, thick, puffy wool, special puffy wool that has eyes all over it in triangle, sort of embossed triangle shapes in the wool, and wearing it is a bit like wearing a hair shirt because it has eyeballs stuck all over it, and it's not backed on the inside, so the scratchiness of the eyeball attachment on the inner side is quite scratchy. But it's great. I love wearing it to play in. So that's the garment on the cover, and I've been wearing it to play shows in, which is really fun. It has a bunch of video that goes with it that I'm putting online in bits and pieces as I'm still working on it. So I'm actually controlling the video and the audio from Ableton Live using like a little Maxim Live beta video player. So I'm able to, if I'm playing something I'm triggering every measure, half measure, which I like to do because then I can sort of leap around and structure things and do quick changes if I'm playing with Kristen. But I really... That's relatively new, playing the video from Ableton, playing everything from Ableton with this Max and Live object doing the video.
So I was going to ask, is your live setup now basically the laptop and that's it, or do you have any kind of outboard stuff as well?
It's a laptop, a Pico projector, like the tiny, mm-hmm. tiny ones, is just so nice to travel with, and it's pretty, yeah, obviously if I'm playing somewhere big with a huge screen, like I'll just use their projector. But traveling, having a little projector, and I bought an Apogee Duet, which I love. I've been doing a lot of multi-channel stuff. I did the most of the record as a 9-channel thing in December, and I got really spoiled, and I love that, and I wish I had a huge chamber, a huge multi-channel chamber to work in every day. So that album exists in an expanded 3D form, and as well as the science fiction chamber music piece that my brother records as Kelly Poehler, and he does electronic music as well, and we're both originally string players. His day job is viola. He's a violist, and so he asked me if I would write a piece with him, and so originally I was going to do the electronics and he was going to write for strings, and we were both going to do the text adaptation, and we ended up both sort of coveting part of the other's assignment, so we both did some of the electronics and we both did writing for strings, which I hadn't done in ages but is really fun, and we both did the adaptation and recorded the voices. It's nice to collaborate. There's not a lot of people I can collaborate thoroughly and completely and inspirationally with, getting to that level of sort of really seamless collaboration. And I have that with Kristen Erickson and with my brother. So I feel lucky to have that. And we're working on a series of pieces of particular repertoire for that that group to, which is the three of us, me and my brother, Mike Kelly, and the violinist, Elise Cooter, who's an excellent violinist who's up for any strangeness we want to make her say or do in the context of the piece. So, which is rare. It's actually rare to find a violinist willing to play really hard material while also wearing goofy makeup and like having to go over and pat a strange fake alien object once in a while.
Well, what you were saying about the multi-channel stuff, you should contact Birmingham University in the UK because they have something like a 20-channel setup.
Oh, cool.
With lots of speakers, and they have... Yeah, so if you're ever in the UK, get hold of Birmingham University. And
I will do that.
And say, can I use your multi-channel audio setup?
Let me in.
They'd probably be very excited to. You know, if you just said, oh, I'll do a quick lecture for you on something in return, they'll probably be all over that. So, and also, yes, very quickly before we draw things to a close, Blectum returned after a hiatus, I believe.
Yeah, the hiatus wasn't that long, really, but since we haven't lived in the same place, we haven't released a new record yet. It's been done, almost done for a long time. Do you want to know the working title or the title? Because it's kind of, we're attached to it at this point.
Oh, I'm good with both. Tell me the one you like best first.
Oh, this is what it will be. It's called Deep Bone, and it's really good, and I really am excited for it to come out. And all I have to do is go to Santa Cruz, where Kristen is living now, and spend a week, and we'll finish it, and then it will be released on an unsuspecting universe.
And what's the working title for it?
Oh, Deep Bone is the...
That's the working title. So yeah. What's the actual title?
Oh, that is the actual title.
So is it? I got confused then because you
sorry,
said.
Sorry, no, it's the working title that is stuck long enough that it is now. The
oh,
official.
Right. So it was initially you were calling it Deep Bone as you were going along in the kind of way it always goes. Be like, ah, let's call it that, and then it sticks.
Well, yeah.
Excellent. Well, if anybody wants to find out more about you, where do they go online? Where should they point their browser pointers?
You can try BlevinBlectum, oneword.com. BlevinBlectum.com.
And I will put a link to that in the little bit of information about the podcast. So before we draw anything to a close, is there anything you want to add before we finish? Is there anything you want to tell us about that we've...
No, missed? Thanks for asking.
Well, thanks ever so much for coming on.
I haven't done this in a really long time, so thanks for bearing with my umming and aahing and tangents.
Oh, no, tangents are good. That's what this podcast's about. I think it always takes people by surprise because I think they're expecting a more kind of structured interview kind of format. And I like to just have a chat with people, and I think that's more fun because you then cover things that maybe wouldn't have got covered. I guess with the whole kind of merry-go-round of kind of album promo for people, sometimes they're like expected to be asked the same questions 100 times. And I could have preferred just to go back over everything somebody's done and pick out the things that seem interesting or novel.
Yeah, I think we hit some good tangents and things that I haven't talked things that I've never talked about before.
And that's what I like to hear, things that you've never talked about before. You see, that's what this podcast's about. So, well, thank you ever so much for talking to me, Blevin.
Thank you.
I will draw things to a close. Just to let you know, I should have let you know at the beginning of this, I will be still on just for a second after I finish, just to have a quick word with you before I actually hang up. So I should have explained that.
I haven't hung up yet. Yeah, I
should have explained that before I started, because now I've let the listeners see a little bit more behind the curtain of how the podcast works. See, this is every episode I kind of forget to tell somebody something. I have to reveal it during the podcast. And it means that eventually somebody's going to have the entire blueprint for how to put it together, and they're going to be able to make it themselves, and then I'll be redundant. So anyway, thank you for joining me. All that's left to say is a future library. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Future Library. Future Library is brought to you by PetPiranha.com and is hosted by myself, Alex Bottom. The podcast is free, but if you do want to show your appreciation, feel free to go along to alexbottom.co.uk and click through to music, where you'll be able to find things that you can buy, or go to asmallglassghost.co.uk where you can buy my latest music. Episodes come out when I feel like it, mostly weekly. But that's it, so thank you for listening.